So I was sort of asked in to fill in today, but I think it's pretty obvious that at this time when the United States is engaged in a global quote-unquote war on terrorism, that we talk very seriously about the relationship between the media and the military establishment in this country, and the very, very close connections and the between corporate media, media monopolies, and the Pentagon, and to talk about the propagandist role that the mainstream media is playing, not only here in this country to sort of stifle any kind of dissent, but reporting from the sites, from the bombing sites of the United States in Afghanistan and, of course, soon Iraq. So my name is Sonali Kolhatkar. I'm a local I'm a broadcaster at KPFK Los Angeles, part of the Pacifica Network. I do the morning show there. I'm new to media. I'm also the vice president of the Afghan Women's Mission that works with the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan. And so the issue of how the media covers Afghanistan is close to my heart. But today I'll be sort of facilitating our four speakers here today who will be sharing with us their knowledge and ideas. Each of them will have about 5 to 7 minutes to say a little bit about what they want to talk about and put out an angle there. And then we're supposed to have about 45 minutes of discussion, and I'd like to make that 45 minutes as productive as possible and make sure that we have all 45 minutes of it to an interaction with the audience. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce Rachel Cohen, who's on my left here. She is a communications director of the media watchdog group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR, which I'm sure many of us are familiar with, and she's also a media analyst. Rachel Cohen, welcome.
Thanks. I guess I'll just very briefly tell you a little bit about what FAIR is, just so you know where I'm coming from. We're a national media watch group. We're based in New York City, but we monitor the media that has a national reach. CNN, ABC, CBS, NBC, New York Times, Washington Post, we're talking the really big mega outlets, and we look for bias and inaccuracy. We try to document it, and we try and build activism around it to help hold the corporate press accountable to the public that it is ostensibly supposed to serve. We have a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. We have a weekly syndicated radio show called Counterspin, which is heard on about 130 stations around the country, mostly community stations. And our website is fair.org if you want to check it out. I thought I'd begin by going back about a year's time to immediately after the September 11th attacks and just reading you some little selections from how some of our best and brightest mainstream media pundits responded to the war, what the immediate sort of climate in talk and public debate, what kind of climate was fostered by the mainstream corporate press. One New York tabloid, the New York Post, which is owned by News Corp, which is Rupert Murdoch's company, same people who bring you Fox News, has a columnist named Steve Dunleavy. And this is a huge paper in New York. He wrote, "The response to this unimaginable 21st century Pearl Harbor should be as simple as it is swift. Kill the bastards. A gunshot between the eyes, blow them to smithereens, poison them if you have to. As for cities or countries that host these worms, bomb them into basketball courts." So that's the New York Post. We also had comments from Rich Lowry, who's the editor of the National Review, which is read on the right, and he's widely sort of brought on as an expert on cable news. You've probably seen him on TV. He was commenting to the Washington Post. This is from September 13th. This is just 2 days after the September 11th attacks last year. "America roused to a righteous anger has always been a force for good. States that have been supporting, if not Osama bin Laden, then people like him need to feel pain. If we flatten part of Damascus or Tehran or whatever it takes, that's part of the solution." So that was in the Washington Post. And then I'll bring you a few words from Bill O'Reilly, who's the NAB's keynote speaker this year. So Bill O'Reilly's in town. He's got his own show on Fox News Channel. He's also now, recently this year, debuted his own radio show on over 200 stations across the country. You know, one of the biggest, best-rated sort of TV cable pundit guys. He had Sam Husseini on as a guest, who's actually a colleague of ours, who does some good media activism work. And so Bill O'Reilly's saying to Sam, "If the Taliban government of Afghanistan does not cooperate, then we will damage that government with air power, probably, all right? We will blast them, because..." And then Sam cuts in, and he says, "Well, who will you kill in the process?" Bill O'Reilly says, "Doesn't make any difference." So thank the NAB for helping spread voices like that more broadly and disseminate them more broadly. Now, you might say, okay, that's Fox News. That's, you know, totally right-wing. I never watch it. It's too much, you know. Well, we did a source study, an op-ed study, rather, of the New York Times and the Washington Post, two of the most influential papers in the world, for the first 3 weeks after the September 11th attacks, to see what kind of voices were on the op-ed page. You know, what kind of debate were we getting in these national major papers? 44 columns clearly stressing military response, you know, attack someone, bomb somebody. Two stressing non-military solutions combined in both papers. You know, so what that says to me is that diplomatic approaches talking about what is international law, what's the process through the UN, etc., a lot of this stuff was just flat out not in the national media debate. And I think that has an incredibly powerful influence on policy and where the country goes to, especially in those initial weeks where the public's supposed to be debating what's the response, how does the country react, etc. You know, this stuff, I'll wrap up shortly so that we can move on and get more discussion going, but this stuff doesn't play out just in commentary or just in punditry. We also see it in news coverage. We also did a source study of the three major network news in the weeks right after September 11th. Who did they bring on as experts when they were having on-camera interviews on the news? Who was it? It was predominantly, like 56%, about former and current government and military officials. People who worked at NGOs, people who are experts on humanitarian crises or international law, or academic experts on Central Asia, all this wealth of other people that you might speak to were, you know, really minimally turned to for interviews. You know, they were there here and there, but majority, you know, former military guys, many of whom actually work, you know, for outlets like CNN, often retain and pay former military people as commentators because they have this access to the Pentagon. I guess I'll just end by telling people about one memo that got leaked from CNN, which I think explains some of the things you haven't heard much about, for instance, the civilian casualties in Afghanistan. There was actually a memo from Walter Isaacson, who's the chair of CNN, which went to his news staff, somehow got leaked, I don't know how the mechanics of that happened, in which he said it would be, quote, perverse to focus too much on civilian suffering in Afghanistan. He instructed the news staff to, if they had to run visuals of, say, a village that was bombed or some sort of devastation or suffering, that they should be framing this with reminders for the U.S. audience that this is a country, by the way, that was run by the Taliban, who harbored the terrorists who killed so many of our people. So in other words, any mention of civilian deaths in Afghanistan should basically be justified by reminders of, you know, what Americans lost. And you even saw sometimes on CNN America, then they would cut to images of the rubble at the World Trade Center. But interestingly enough, they did not sometimes do this on CNN International because it's a different audience. There's a wealth of stuff from different angles to talk about. I'm hoping all the different panelists will have different approaches. So I'll leave it there and hope to come back to things and questions.
Thank you, Rachel. Our next panelist is a local public access cable TV producer, produces a program called Somali Sun TV, and serving the Seattle Somali community. And he made his name is Mahdi Mawil, and I want to ask you, Mahdi, if you can talk a little bit about your experience, what has sort of brought you into a place such as this, a space such as this, and how the war, the quote unquote war on terror, and its ramifications here at home has had, what effect that's had on your community and yourself.
Thank you very much. I just want to warn you guys, I have a beautiful accent, so if you guys can cope with that, I'll appreciate.
I
can speak louder? Okay.
I've
got a heavy voice too. Can I speak? Okay. Which one? That one or this one or that one? Okay. Okay. Thank you. That was a good question. When I came to America, I landed in a place called New York, where my parents had to sell half of cattle that we used to own. And that was basically assets just to come to America, a land called, you know, freedom, or the land we thought that we had a dream to come here someday. And I'm glad I did. Some other Somalis made it. I came to New York, and one day I was running around.
Just speak up a little bit more, if you can just project a little bit.
Can I stand up? Okay. As you guys put me far back so people can see me. Okay. Would it be okay for the audio-wise, guys? Okay. So when I came to about 4 years ago, I landed in New York, and then still?
Use a microphone.
Can you guys actually come a little bit closer? That might also help things, because we don't, these microphones.
Okay, do I have to
hold? Are these actually projecting out on the speaker?
No,
none of these. These are just all for audio taping, so they aren't supposed to.
Well, I have a question. How come she has a louder voice than I don't? See? Oh, okay.
Is it possible for people to come a little bit closer, if that's okay, for you to turn the table a little bit
too? I think we better people just better come in.
Let's try again.
Yeah, just talk louder.
Just go on.
Okay. It's funny. I came here 4 years ago, and I landed in New York, and then I started volunteering. One day we were praying in front of Friday prayer that was taking place in front of the White House. And then I met this African-American lady by the name of Hasna, who produced public access back in D.C., Arlington, Virginia, actually called Islamic Perspectives. So I became a volunteer, and then that is how I hooked up with this alternative media, first of all. And I don't have any second that I'm regretting. I was thankful for running over to that lady, that wonderful lady, for that day. Ever since, I decided to go to school of journalism, and I'm still doing that. I have to learn English first, obviously. So when I came to Seattle, the raid that took place, I used to have a travel agency next door to that, and then I became a producer of a public access just for the Somalis, because I relocated from almost 2 years ago from DC area to come to Seattle area because of the weather, because of a lot of communities that we have, because of family members that I have here personally. So that, it was 7:30 in the morning when a friend of mine called me and said, Mahdi, do you know what is happening in your travel agency area? I didn't know. So I put the radio, because they were mentioning that there was some wrongdoing that was taking place on a tiny little grocery called Makamini Market, where they used to deliver, where they used to have another office within that office called Al Barakat, where we used to send the money. So the raid happened at about 6:30 in the morning, and then what the mainstream media didn't report was that they took the first person who was opening the door that morning. He doesn't speak the English, the brother. So they physically take him. In 2 years, they held up someplace and they took him to his own apartment. And then they investigated him. They thought that he was, you know, hiding God knows what. But 2 hours later, they released him. So I get out my, you know, handheld camera, and then from point A to Z, I tried to, it took me 3 days to record, you know, whatever that I could get my hands on. And I have a mixed feelings the way the raid happened today. I can say that because I didn't want it to happen the way it did, because we remain, they label us like we were a terrorist, or we were something that's got to do that we were funding, you know, Osama bin Laden or anybody, you know, who can relate to that. Simply because we are Muslims, we are Somalis, you know, we are blacks, we are immigrants, we are new to the land. So thanks to God, but thanks to the public access, thanks to the people that I, you know, came to realize, to know, because I figure there was a completely different world outside, you know, outside the tiny little scope. I have a mixed feeling today because they came up hard in a tough time because of September 11. We said ever since, you know, we are here, we said we've got nothing to do with the terrorism. And the heat is still on, you know, against Muslims in general, but particularly in Somalis, because 4 months later they came and did the food stamp. They shut it down, the three different stores, that including Makkah Mini Market, that they said we cannot use it because of, again, illegal activity, which turns out to be false again. So I don't know whether I'm making myself clear, but I was told that I have a few more minutes, you know, that I can just say it. I don't prepare notes. I'm here to, you know, talk about personal experience. And being a Muslim, being a Somali, being an immigrant is a, you know, tough place to be. Thanks to, you know, each and every individual, you know, that I came to know because of that raid. There was people like Randy, you know, Roland here. I didn't know him from Adam or Eve in that case. This guy just came along the way and shot because of the demonstration that we, the whole Somali community, that we did within 24 hours. Because I knew that Abdel Nasser Ali Nur, who happens to be the owner of Makkah Mini Market, said, I knew because personally he's a friend of mine, because we're, you know, the place, I don't know whether you guys are familiar or not, it's 4419 South Brandon Street, is that intersection with Brandon and Rainier. So I was told before we came here, you know, as a Somalis, Rainier Valley used to be like, you know, a place that white people in general don't feel comfortable going in. So in other words, we Somalis came and established our own business, and as hardworking as we are, a lot of people fail, you know, to mention that. We created our own business, and then, you know, the government came in and did what they had to do. Abdel Nasser still didn't get a penny out of it. They only paid him, they didn't pay him, they give him back for $41,000, which they seized when they came, when the raid happened that morning. So he still has to get his, I was talking to him last night. I invited him, you know, to be here, but he's still running his own business. Thanks to the, you know, general public, the neighborhood, the city of Seattle in general, that neighborhood alone. So I've got a chance to interview a lot of, you know, some of the officials like McDermott and the different organizations that I came to know personally and business-wise. And their first question when the media came that morning was, simply because I was a travel agent, and this reporter from Seattle Times said, how many, let me rephrase that. He said, where do you sell these tickets towards who? Do you know any, do you sell a lot of tickets to Afghanistan or to Middle East? I said, I'm a travel agent. I can sell you know, tickets to whoever wants to pay, you know, their tickets. So again, that's how I came to this alternative media, and I love it, and I will never go back, and I'm here to reclaim the media. And NAB sucks.
Thank you, Mahdi. Before we go to our next speaker, Pramila, if you could grab this. I just want to make a quick announcement. If you haven't already registered for the conference, the conference organizers would really like to remind people to register. It's a suggested donation of $20 to $30 so that they can pay the cost of the conference, and it also includes admissions to the, admission to this evening's keynote event with Amy Goodman and Democracy Now, and then also admission to tomorrow night's Macaroni Awards and Sunday's premiere to the documentary Culture Jam. And so please do register for the conference if you haven't already. Our next speaker is the executive director of the Seattle-based nonprofit Hate Free Zone. She's also the author of Pilgrimage, One Woman's Return to a Changing India. Her name is Pramila Jayapal. Welcome.
Thanks, Sonali. So I'll try to speak this way and this way. It's a sort of a strange setup we have here. I'm here, I guess, as the only person who's not actively involved in the media, and I'm here really to talk a little bit about my perception of how the media is covering both our international war on terrorism and our domestic war on terrorism, and what that means for the work that I'm doing personally. Just as a way of background, and will you give me a time? Will you tell me when my time is up? Great, thanks. Just as way of background, the Hate Free Zone campaign of Washington was established after September 11th, a week after September 11th, very much as a grassroots sort of volunteer-based effort to try and address the hate crimes and discrimination that many different immigrant communities of color were experiencing. And when we started, we really thought that this was, we started because there were hate crimes. There were people, women who had their hijab being pulled down. There were Sikhs who were being murdered across the country. Actually, as it turned out, there were six Sikh men who were killed by people who thought that they were linked somehow to Osama bin Laden because they wear turbans. There were, of course, the Arab Americans who were being targeted in many different ways. And we really thought we were dealing with individual hate crimes perpetrated against other individuals. And what we found in the year since we've been in existence, and we've grown now, we have a full-time staff of five people, and we are just inundated with work. About 60% of our work is actually addressing federal government actions and policies that directly target immigrant communities of color based on ethnicity or religion. So what I'm seeing here is that there's always, war is a quest for power and for the United States to be able to perpetrate their own hate crimes across the world. I mean, this is not something new to anybody who's here, I'm sure. And what we do in a time of war is we use patriotism. We, meaning the administration, uses the idea of patriotism to bring people together to support whatever actions they're taking on. What we've seen personally and in the work that I'm doing at the Hate Free Zone is that this call for patriotism then quells dissension. It's an attempt to try and quell dissension. We already had that prior to September 11th. The movement of the United States was to try and quell dissension. If you look at anti-globalization efforts, if you look at sort of a number of different things, that there has been this movement by the US government to try and stop that dissension. What we had after September 11th was the war of you're either with us or against us. And so when you're given a choice like that, there are many Americans who will say, well, of course, we're with you. I mean, and guess who's saying it the most? Our congressional delegation, who passed the USA, not our congressional delegation, our US Congress, who passed the USA Patriot Act a few weeks after September 11th, and who have, in spite of a series of actions taken by the US government post-September 11th, have not come up to really voice their concerns about how our how safety and the issues of safety have to be balanced against the issues of civil rights and our own constitutional rights. One of the things that I'm seeing in the media, and I'm seeing just in, you know, in general, again, with our congressional delegation, and I'm going to mention we have a public hearing coming up on September 21st here at Town Hall. That's next Saturday from 10:30 to 1:30, where you're going to hear people from a number of different immigrant communities come forward in spite of tremendous fear to testify about what the impact has been on them personally. And we really are asking all of you, particularly those of you who are in non-affected communities, to the extent that I can say that, I think we're all affected, but we're making a plea for you to come out and support these communities, because many of them cannot come forward because they are too afraid, and they have every right to be afraid. And this is the time for all of us as Americans to say we stand together on this issue. What I'm finding is that the media is not covering certain things because it, like our elected representatives, are afraid of being perceived as soft on terrorism. And of course, we know all the connections with corporate, the media's, the mainstream progressive media is controlled by corporations. We know that. And we're seeing that here in terms of how many of you actually have any idea about the extent to which U.S. policies are affecting immigrant communities. You maybe read a story about the Hamoui family, the Syrian family that's been in detention. Hanan Hamoui was pulled out of bed by her hair by the FBI on the first day of Eid, the holy month of the Islamic calendar. And the family was taken into detention. The kids were taken into detention. So maybe you know about the Hamoui family. Maybe you know about the Somali grocery stores because of the wonderful work Mahdi is doing. The Hate-Free Zone coordinated most of the campaign around the defense for the grocery stores. We weren't actively involved in the money transmitter businesses, but we were very actively involved in filing the appeal for the grocery stores. And all three of them, as Mahdi sort of mentioned, have been told that they, oh yes, we made a mistake, we are not guilty. That should be front news coverage. I mean, you know, we should be talking about how what we have in this country right now is act now, explain later sort of attitude. And so I think that that's the part that is, what's not being covered in the media is the systematic war on free speech and on really expressing what's happening, what's really happening behind the scenes here. This is not just sort of an action here, an action there, a policy here, a policy there. It's a planned series of events that mirrors exactly what the United States has been doing overseas. And so that's really, I think, what I might be able to bring to this panel. If you have questions about how that's affecting immigrant communities, I'd love to talk about that some more.
And finally, I'm going to introduce Jev Parrish, but I also want to encourage the audience today to think about what Pramila just mentioned. And to ask ourselves maybe the question, as many of us here are independent media makers, whether the independent media has done a good enough job of covering the issues of certain immigrant communities from South, Central, and West Asia effectively enough or sensitively enough. But I'll turn the floor over to Jev Parrish. He writes, he's our last panelist here today who hasn't spoken yet. Jev writes for a growing list of local and national progressive publications, including Eat the State, which I believe you can pick up here today, including the Seattle Weekly, WorkingForChange.org, and Alternet. And he's a regular guest on KEXP's Mind Over Matters, and a longtime micro radio broadcaster as well as peace activist. Welcome, Jev.
Thank you. This weekend and this panel even is sort of an interesting, this is my life sort of convergence of many themes that I've sort of followed over the years. Two of the main things that I've done through most of my adult life are work in media and work to stop war. I am, among other things, was on staff at KPFT, the Pacifica station in Houston, for several years. Worked in commercial and non-commercial radio for about 15 years, including several years where I worked with a company that went to these NAB conventions twice a year, one the combined radio TV and then the smaller radio convention. I stopped that due to my desire to do full-time community activism that included working as a tenant organizer in Arlington for a couple of years. I've been in Seattle for a number of years now, sort of accidentally came back into media again by starting Eat the State as a newsletter several years ago. That got a tremendous community response. The Stranger offered me a column. The Weekly started trying to hire me away. One thing has led to another, and now I'm syndicated nationally and I have all of these forums. I've been on the board, the National Board of War Resisters League, for 16 years and have done a number of what many people would consider fairly radical things in my quest to publicize this country's military-industrial complex, the many war crimes that have been committed in the names of each of us. And for some reason, the things that were considered fringe, loony, activist, weirdo stuff 15 years ago are now considered respectable commentary because I have a title in front of my name and a widely seen soapbox, and I'm saying the same things. Coming into this, having sort of had a foot in all of these doors, I was over at the NAB this afternoon, and I remember what it's like to be in corporate media and what that mindset is like. And then I come over here and have a tremendous affinity for what people are trying to do here. And I think there's some fairly common misunderstandings about how corporate media works. There's particularly a truism, I think, on the left, that corporate media tends to skew right. Of course, there's also the bias among conservatives of the liberal media, and there's some truth to both. Our mainstream corporate media is socially very liberal. If you listen to any morning show with its sex and titillation, it's hard to, you know, imagine that those are good Christian fundamentalist values that they're perpetrating. At the same time, you know, the sort of documentation that FAIR has been doing for many years, and the program that I'm on KEXP tomorrow morning and Saturday mornings comes immediately after Counterspin, which is an excellent program, 8 o'clock on KEXP, and now it's on KBCS on Tuesday evenings as well. The documentation is there in terms of who is interviewed, what types of stories get play, how they get play. But the real bias in mainstream media, and that's not just radio, it's also TV, it's also print media, newspapers and magazines, isn't really conservative or liberal. It's a bias toward power. It's a bias toward the status quo. It's a bias, particularly in news gathering, toward interviewing and taking seriously and parroting the views of people in power, people who are in position to make public policy decisions. So what you see on the programs like Nightline, and again the sort of things that FAIR has documented, is that the people who are considered experts in these various issues, the people whose opinions are taken seriously and who we're all told to emulate, and who really set the boundaries of what's considered an acceptable spectrum of debate over a particular policy, tend to be people who work in government, work in academia, are spokespeople for corporations, have some sort of a title in front of their name. You rarely hear from citizen activists. You rarely hear from people who have educated themselves in terms of expertise on a particular corporation or a particular industry or a particular issue. And so when it comes to war, you get a very narrow spectrum, and particularly since 9/11, because we have had no real political opposition to many of the things that the Bush administration has been perpetrating, both in terms of war overseas, the tremendous expansion of our military presence, not just in Afghanistan, but 60 different countries around the world, the unleashing of our intelligence agencies, the ability of those agencies to hire people with tremendous human rights abuse records, the incredible increase in our military spending here at home, and of course the vast increase in policies that abuse civil liberties and call into question the Bill of Rights and our constitutional rights here at home, the way immigrants are treated. There has not been very much political opposition among Democrats or among conservative and libertarian Republicans to those policies. And so because the bias is toward the status quo, you don't hear many of those views in the mainstream media either. And what happens in any propaganda system, and that really is effectively what our supposedly free media is, it's a propaganda system, because we have television networks and radio networks and corporate media that act as stenographers to power, regardless of whether they're Republicans or Democrats. What happens with that is it sets the bounds of acceptable debate on an issue, and the question is repetition. Repetition is the key to successful advertising, successful marketing, and a successful indoctrination, so that I may be able to get a story in here or there. I've been able, actually, to get into corporate media as a political commentator and get fairly radical views into daily newspapers, onto the radio, into places like the Seattle Weekly, where a lot of people will see it. But it's one story, or it's one column, or it's one commentary out of dozens or hundreds or thousands that people might see on a topic. And that's the challenge that we have when producing alternative media and when trying to stop the war, is that we don't have very good access to those large general media forums that a lot of people see. We don't have access to the kind of repetition of the message that can call into question some of the assumptions that are being perpetrated on us around the necessity, for instance, of a war against Iraq. So we have to formulate a message that is very effective for the few opportunities that we get. We have to formulate a message that is not just what we want to say, but what an audience that needs to take action, that needs to pressure the White House, that needs to hold our elected leaders of both parties accountable for what they're doing and for what they're not doing. We need to make that message as effective as possible to convince people to become active, that they can make a difference, and to take action to hold our leaders accountable. We have to formulate that message based on what those folks need to hear, not necessarily on what we want to say. We have to do it in a way that avoids jargon, avoids rhetoric, and calls people into action. Because if we don't get people to do those actions in the limited opportunities that we have, we're going to continue to have these wars. And they're going to be wars that victimize people overseas, and they're going to be wars that victimize people next door. And eventually, when the anti-Americanism that it foisters kicks into action, they're gonna affect you and I in some very real ways as well. So we have a very real responsibility for ourselves as well as for our neighbors and for people around the world to formulate that message, to get that message out there, to take action ourselves, and to encourage as many other people as possible to stop these wars and stop the things that are being done in each of our names. Stop there.
Thank all the panelists today, and we'll open it up for questions in just a minute, but I also want to throw out for all of us here to think about the fact that we're about to go to war with Iraq. I mean, we've essentially begun, and we're just waiting for the UN to either give us the go-ahead so that we can do it or to say no so that we can do it anyway. But, you know, the majority of Americans aren't convinced, and that's a huge, huge resource for us to tap into. As I was flying over here, you have these standard airline magazines on Southwest Airlines, and I just happened to flip through this magazine, and they had a media story called "Eat My Dust" about all these various anchors, and a little box on Phil Donahue where they said the Conservative National Review labels Donahue, quote, a tired figure from the left wing's glorious yesterday. Howard Rosenberg, LA Times television critic and self-proclaimed far-left liberal, calls Donahue a smart, well-informed man and a capable devil's advocate. But, he says, it seems to me that people who come from the left are just not as good as good at this. His opinion is shared by media analyst Andrew Tyndall, who believes that, quote, the abrasive, bombastic style of conservative TV pundits, think Pat Buchanan or Sean Hannity of Fox's Hannity and Combs, simply plays better on television. When talk show gladiators clash, says Tyndall, the liberal voice can sound wishy-washy and uncertain. Donahue is a throwback to an earlier age when it was the left wing that was opinionated and bombastic, says Tyndall. He's interesting, but he's a bit long in the tooth now. So, I mean, these are the kinds of, so basically Pat Buchanan, we're being told, is what the public really wants to hear. But is that true? I'd like to open the floor up to questions now and see what we can what kind of conversation we can get. So go ahead and speak loud.
Each of you are going to give one publication, a newspaper or a periodical, to your public library so that people could feel that they could go in and get informed. What would you give?
Let's repeat the question. Hold on. The question was if there was... Okay, Wen.
Yeah. The question was for each of the panelists, and I hope somebody else will answer first, if we have one publication that we could give to our public libraries that would, you know, inform and give information to the public that we would want to see out there, what would that publication be?
Well, I can try to even answer. I mean, I think it's an unfair question because I think that when we talk about the issues that we want to talk about, there naturally has to be a diversity of opinions. If we're going to just put forward one publication, it's like saying, well, you know, Clear Channel is just one company. I think
we
should...
I would
say, you know, we should get our public libraries to carry Z Magazine, carry even, you know, carry The Nation, carry The Progressive, Covert Action Quarterly, Clamor Magazine, Eat the State.
Fair, Extra is very good. Yeah.
Any other? There
are a huge number of good publications out there, and even more of them on the website. A lot of resources that are out there. If you go looking for it, the trick is that you have to be motivated to go looking for them, and having them readily available for people to just come across is the real challenge.
Well, and to also remember that there's also, you know, written publications are not the way that many of the communities in America actually get information either. So, you know, if we could broaden that question maybe I think that that's also an important piece of it, is to make sure that we have all different kinds of media available so that people who aren't reading are also just as informed about the issues.
Yeah. And I would say also not just a particular type of commentary. I think we tend to get trapped into the idea that the essay or opinion column or written exposé is the best way to communicate to people. Culture is also a very important way to spread a message of what an alternative world would look like, or to critique policy. Humor is very important. Mm-hmm. There are any number of art. There are a number of different ways that you can reach people, and we should be trying to encourage a diversity of ways to communicate.
Yes, there was one hand up there. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the tricks is to read as widely as you can. One of the things, I spend a lot of time monitoring mainstream press, probably way more time than I would like to otherwise if it weren't my field. Sometimes there's a great story in the New York Times or the Washington Post. You know, good stuff does get in there, and those outlets have tremendous resources. For instance, the Boston Globe, definitely a big corporate paper. They have two reporters, John Donnelly and Anthony Shadid, who did one of the best investigations of civilian casualties in Afghanistan that we've had in the mainstream American press. You know, stuff gets in there from time to time. They actually went to Afghanistan and in person investigated specific villages and sites and did their own count. We've seen hardly anyone else do that. My advice to people with this kind of thing is always read skeptically, whatever it is. If it's mm-hmm. The Nation, if it's the New York Times, whoever it is, read skeptically. And try to compare different sources. If you have any access to the internet at all, if you can get any access to foreign press, if you speak any other language, that's an amazing resource just to, you know, test out different perspectives. But again, you know, we do recognize that people have jobs and everyone has time.
Foreign press.
Yeah.
What? Who do you guys watch in the foreign press?
I look at The Guardian a lot, which is a London paper.
Yeah. There are a number of British newspapers that really give a very different view of the world than what you get in most corporate U.S. media. www.guardian.co.uk, The Independent, The Daily Telegraph, The Irish Times is very good. I mean, even The London Times, very conservative newspaper, very much from sort of the British financial Tory viewpoint, but you can still get news, and particularly because foreign press takes international news much more seriously than our press does here. That's a mindset
because we're geographically isolated in the United States. That's a financial consideration because corporations here have really cut back on foreign news because it costs money to gather it. And, you know, it's a feedback loop because audience surveys indicate that audience doesn't care much in this country about foreign news, so it gets dropped, especially from television news. But in the foreign media, even the CBC in Canada, but British, a lot of foreign newspapers in different parts of the world on the internet have weekly English language editions, particularly valuable for Central Asia and the Middle East. There's a lot of good information out there on the internet.
And if I could add one comment also, the business pages are definitely very honest. The Wall Street Journal carries excellent stories. And also one note of caution when we do look at the foreign media. For example, if you want to get the scoop on India and Pakistan, don't read the Times of India and think that they're going to tell the truth, right? If you want to know what's going on in Ireland, don't trust the Times of London, the London Times. Media tend to have a much bigger bias when it comes to reporting on their own state. Mm-hmm. That's why the European media are better at reporting on the US, and that's why the British media are probably better at reporting on India and Pakistan as well, but the Times of India is better at reporting on the US, etc. So keep that in mind. I think it's also important.
And where is the US good on reporting it?
That's a good question. Hey, but you can find out all about basketball.
Celebrity pages, yeah.
Other questions? I think there was a hand up here. Yeah.
I'm quite sure I got this question, but I've always wondered about the value of public relations that corporate media has brought to getting their message out there, to accommodate some of their audience. So if you were talking about, you know, essentially forming out a message to put out there, is there a way to leverage public relations or at least the ideas from public relations?
The question is how do the mainstream media use public relations to get their message to dominate the media, and are there any lessons that we could learn from PR tricks? Would anyone like to tackle that?
Sure. Well, I can start. Some of the tactics that mainstream media that say corporations or whoever use for PR for mainstream media, we probably don't want to duplicate. Some of them work because of corporate consolidation. You know, every time there's another media merger, news budgets get slashed, especially foreign news budgets go first. Reporters are under more and more pressure to produce more stories in a shorter period of time. They don't have time to do any research. They're going to use whatever slickest PR packet comes first, and it's going to be, you know, Citicorp or whoever, the biggest corporations that have like a whole staff of people devoted to basically pre-writing news stories. That kind of thing is, I think, inherently undemocratic. That said, sure, there's always, you know, I don't know, I hear a lot of criticisms of the left that if they, you know, you guys don't have your message together enough, you're not slick enough. I don't know that it's always true. Sometimes it's true, sure. You got to do your press releases better or whatever. You got to proofread them. But I think the fundamental problem with getting our message out or getting progressive messages out is the structure that we're trying to get them into, which is one of the reasons that I think these larger questions about media reform, why coming out and protesting the NAB and these things are applicable to a whole range of struggles on the left.
Yeah, I would agree. In terms of putting my activist hat on for a minute, one of the things that you try and do when getting a message into media, and now that I'm working as a reporter, I can sort of see the other side of it too. Rachel is absolutely right. Reporters have very little time to investigate, to dig deep. Very often, they're put on beats that they're not experts in. They're not really up to speed on. If you can establish relations with different reporters on a beat, if you can introduce yourself ahead of time so they know who you are, so that you're in their Rolodex before an event happens. Half of the battle is being considered a credible source. And you know, part of that is having a message together. Part of that is looking and sounding the way people in the media expect an expert or a resource on a story to look and sound like. And part of it is simply the content of the message itself not being something that they're comfortable with, they're familiar with. So mainstream media is not a monolith. There are people within mainstream media who will put good stories out that you can establish relationships with. But it just takes a lot of persistence, and sometimes it's not going to work.
And also having a title helps.
Yes,
that they like,
very much so.
Like you mentioned earlier. The guy in the blue hat, and then next.
Can you speak to the issue of the emotionalism of news coverage in America? Because when you read things from other parts of the world, you can tell that people have a long-term knowledge of that. And we in America have this soundbite mentality. Because I think that's what my biggest struggle is with talking to people one-on-one is you know, where are you at? What are you doing? You know, I mean, where's your mind at? You know, as well as your emotions.
So I think there are two questions here. One is commenting on the, I suppose you mean sensationalism in the major news media where they'll report on the latest disaster without putting a context to it. And then the other question is, how do you get them to select you as an expert?
Yeah. I'll take a stab at both. I hope other people will too. The sensationalism, I think, is a function of the fact that almost all of our general audience media is for-profit media. It's very much driven by the bottom line, and the bottom line means that you want to have as many audience members as possible of whatever particular demographic you're trying to attract, and the content isn't really that important. Stories do not get selected in most news operations in this country anymore on the basis of newsworthiness alone. It's on the basis of what will play for the audience that you want. And, you know, if that's a car crash, even if you have a car crash every night, or a, you know, robbery or a gunshot or whatever, that's what'll play. If it's a front page photo of a girl playing in a sprinkler with a squirrel, that's the photo that'll run on the front page. So there really is, I think, a loss, especially as media has consolidated, and as the bottom line has become more and more important. There's been a loss of news judgment amongst corporate media in this country. In terms of the how do you become an expert...
Could I make a
oh, sure.
just on that same note before yeah. we answer that? I think that I would maybe disagree a little bit in that I think part of it, it's true what you're saying, that people are on deadlines and they'll take what they get, but then there is a very... I mean, this panel is called Media and War, and there is a concerted effort to put forth a sensationalized... event or sensationalize a particular issue if and when mm-hmm. it serves the purpose. One issue that I study a lot, which I'll be talking about later this evening, is looking at how Afghan women's oppression was dealt with by the major media in this time of war, completely sensationalized. At the same time, the complete terrorizing of Muslim women in Gujarat, India, that happened since February of this year was practically ignored, and there were hundreds of Indian Muslim women who were gang raped and burned alive. I mean, how many people heard that? But that wasn't covered because, you know, India is our friend now, and so it's very much, I think, the mainstream media will sensationalize when it's, especially when in times of war it serves the purpose, just as we had a few years ago in Yugoslavia when the US began its bombing campaign. Suddenly the people that you were supposed to feel the most sorry for in the world were suffering Albanians in Kosovo, and you know, before that time nobody was necessarily paying attention. So
yeah, we had the Kuwaiti incubator babies during
right.
the Gulf War, which turned out later to be false.
Yeah.
No, that's absolutely true. In terms of the how do you get in the Rolodex, how do you become one of the experts, I think there's a real danger there. I mean, you do want to become a source, you do want to become active, but I think it's also the nature of alternative media, and one of the things we're trying to accomplish with alternative media is train people that everybody's voice is important. You know, we've really learned in this culture that, you know, unless what you're thinking and feeling and perceiving isn't reflected back to you on television, it's not real. You and everybody you know may have problems with the healthcare system in this country, but it's not on the evening news every night, so it must be an isolated problem. We've gotten away from the idea that your and my voices on particular issues can be important, and that to me should be the bedrock of a democracy. So at the same time that we're trying to get our message out and trying to convince people within general audience media outlets that our message is important, we should also be trying to encourage them to broaden their sources more generally, number one, and we should be developing our own media institutions where our message isn't mediated through large corporations, and using those alternative media sources to reach out to our neighborhoods, to reach out to our friends and co-workers and you know, people that we know, and encouraging all of them to speak out as well and to have their voices heard, because that's an important part of what we're missing.
Rachel, did you want to comment?
And did the other panelists also?
Did you have another question, maybe?
Okay. Did you want to make a quick comment?
Quick comment. I was at something a couple of months ago, and there was a reporter from the Oregonian who actually is a columnist who writes a lot of good stuff. But we ended up in a huge debate in that group about really the role of the media, whether it is to essentially pander to the people who just want to open the sports page and read the 5 minutes, you know, spend the 5 minutes that they have reading the sports page, or whether the media has a role in actually furthering a debate on a specific issue, and what are the debates that the media chooses to further further the conversation about? Because there are some. I also do work in domestic violence, and I remember I was asked to do an article on domestic violence for a paper, and they said, you know, there isn't a lot of interest in this issue, but we feel it's really important, and so we're actually willing to, you know, open up this conversation. Now, that has not been true for the work I've been doing post September 11th. And in fact, when I've submitted an op-ed piece and they've said, yes, we'd like to take this, a newspaper has said, yes, we'd like to take this, but we would like you to tone it way down. And of course, then the conversation comes back to me about, am I willing to do that in order to get something in a mainstream outlet, and compromise really what I feel should be in there, or am I just going to keep it out altogether? So, I mean, I think there are a lot of issues that come up around what that bottom line focus means in terms of the role of the media in furthering public debate. And that's something you don't see in this country the way you do in other countries, you know.
We had a question from a gentleman over here.
Okay. On the first question about the the first question was: is it true that there are now roughly twice as many PR flacks in the country as there are journalists? Roughly, yes. There's the best place for figures on this is PR Watch, PRWatch.org.
It's great website.
Yeah, they're fabulous. They do great work. It's John Stauber and Sheldon Rampton, the two guys who run it. It's actually an interesting thing. The PR industry, most of the people in it went to journalism school or used to be journalists. In fact, that's a major career path in J school now, journalism school, is to go straight into PR. Or people who've been working as a local journalist who are frustrated, underpaid, overworked, they'll go into PR. And the ratio, I think, is steadily becoming more unbalanced. There's more and more PR. And what that means is not just that journalists are besieged by PR, it's that PR people are actually writing the stories you read. This is particularly true, actually, with a thing called video news releases. which are your local TV news, not the national news, but your local news. A lot of the stories you see, especially health-related stories,
this, you know, guy who died, which, you know, the whole idea was the humanitarian mission, and that's what they failed to mention. And nobody ever represent the Somali point of view. There was a Malaysians who were involved. There was a Pakistani point of view that the movie didn't cover. So it's nothing other than a pathetic, and that's what O'Reilly himself, this idiot guy, who offered one of these Somali brothers, I don't know whether he's from Columbus, Ohio, or Minneapolis, and he has his show, and the brother didn't have that much of ticket. I personally called, you know, the show, but he was checking enough to have any other person, but he's basically moved, you know, as idiot as he can be. So that is what I can say. I'll definitely give you, you know, a copy of that. And that is that the answer to your question? Or
I have a question for you, Zomadi, and maybe some of the other panelists can also comment on this. Is that I think as independent media makers, we should be looking at ourselves a little bit and trying to critique ourselves a little bit, which is. How would you assess the independent media coverage of of everything that's been happening post 9/11, especially with relation to immigrants? Because I started noticing after 9/11, a lot of us in the independent media would make little faux pas. Afghanistan being, you know, Afghanistan and Arab, the Arab world being mixed up. I mean, these are superficial things, but then they sort of add up to, you know, South Asians and doing this. Making the same mistakes that sometimes the major media made about that part of the world, which just isn't, I guess, much necessarily, or didn't used to be much, very much in the forefront in progressive media, progressive movements. What is your assessment as an immigrant, but also an independent media maker, of how the independent media covered things?
Honestly, without, you know, being one side, the way the independent media cover is there is a truth to it. There is an edited version of it. There's from point A to Z, and there is the book that I believe in. I happen to be a Muslim, and there's a very beautiful all of it is it is a beautiful, but one specific version says that he had a success, the one who purifies himself. So self-beautification has to start from the individual. So anybody can take a camera and shoot the event, but do you really have that desire, you know, to go there? Is there that need? Do that individual has all of these, you know, people could have been anywhere else today, but they chose to be in here. So that is what, you know, drives me to become an independent media, you know, a part of it. Because all of us has a responsibility as a human being, you know, whether you're no matter what kind of a, you know, color you belong to or what kind of a faith that you might have, we all have the same blood. So independent media. Yes, we are all part of it, whether we like it or not. But there's sometimes issues that you cannot not, you know, get away from it. So one way or the other, we are human beings and have a selfishness point of view, that issues that you might really care. But as long as we can, you know, cover as it is, you know, the truth, you know, should be told. So that's, I'm glad.
I think that the big difference I see in the independent media coverage is that, or getting coverage, is that there are more people who are willing to listen. There's more of an opening there. But ultimately, I think a lot of it comes down to representation in media in general, I mean, independent or otherwise, because the people that I find most interested in covering the kinds of issues I'm talking about are people who have some personal experience with the issue. And that's not always true. And, you know, I'm not making a generalization, but I think that there is still this issue of having to educate, as you said, about who a Sikh is. You know, well, why should we even be talking about this, not just as an Arab-American issue, but an issue that's affecting East Africans, that's affecting South Asians. Who are South Asians? Then that question comes, you know. And so I do think that there's a lot of education that we're having to do, whether it's mainstream media or independent media, but there is much more of a willingness to listen, and there's much more of an openness. But I think a lot of it is still in progress, and I would say that we've had some success with the independent media, but there's still a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, I want to piggyback on that. There is, I think, a tremendous truth to the idea that reporters being individuals bring their own experiences into whatever story they consider doing, and particularly in mainstream media, where you get biases or where you get misleading coverage is in what they don't choose to cover or what they omit from a story or bury in paragraph 35. Yeah. This, I think, also is where diversity in the newsroom comes into play, and the radio industry in particular is very bad with this. For several years now, the radio newsrooms have actually been declining in the number of women and minorities that are hired for radio news. And that's something to hold the NAB accountable this weekend. The flip side is that I've been tremendously frustrated, particularly since 9-1-1, with factual errors that pop up in alternative media. And I realize that many independent outlets don't have the resources for fact-checking that a commercial outlet does. But credibility is important, particularly because we may not feel that we're competing against, say, the New York Times or the Seattle Times or PI or a television news outlet. But in terms of our audience, they're looking at all of these things. They're looking at the production values, and they're looking at the information conveyed. So it's important that we, if we have a particular viewpoint, have the facts to back up that viewpoint and that they be accurate. And I think we have a ways to go on that sometimes.
I think we're pretty much out of time. Is there like a totally burning question that somebody feels needs to ask to complete this discussion?
I want to ask you, because you're so young, and so really fresh my mind. I came out of a background of publishing in the 50s and the 60s, and I saw a very deep interest then in building a trust like the 20th Century Trust Fund that could publish books that were genuinely free and open, and you knew they had checked everything, but they weren't indebted to anybody, maybe by corporate interests. And I see then it got mentioned that the London Guardian Weekly is the only publication I read that is built out of the structure of an institution of public trust, where that money is there, and you can build qualitative investigative journalism without the fear of having to, about paychecks.
Yeah.
What do you look forward to, as young people? What structure do you want?
It's not the money. Just say that right now.
I think what you're basically talking about is the ideal of what public broadcasting could be and public media could be.
Yeah.
Right now, our public broadcasting is in a pretty sad state. But ideally, if you had, set aside a certain amount of taxes or tax certain things or even put a tax on advertising, there's a lot of different proposals out there to really fund local independent media. I think if you're talking about long-term solutions, like what we can work for, that's it. That's what we need. And, of course, you need then a firewall between wherever the funding's coming from and all the editorial decisions. But, long-term, we need to break up the corporate media monopolies, and I think public-funded, small, localized media, absolutely, yeah.
And one of the biggest challenges of alternative media is institutionalizing. I know with Eat the State, for example, we're on issue like 230-something, and it's much harder to publish issue number 3 than issue number 1, and to keep it going over the years, particularly past the time where the first people that started it have moved on.
The difference between the people over here and the people in the convention center this weekend is the amount of passion that we bring toward creating our media. But that has to be sustainable over the long term in order for us to have the kind of impact that we do. You do have to worry about money. You have to worry about the people that are creating this media being able to not have to do day jobs at the same time, to be able to really focus on it and to really make it a community-based institution. That's a tremendous challenge, and there are no easy answers, but that is the challenge.
And I would add that in these kinds of progressive media institutions, one of the things that I hope we move away from more and more is mimicking the same hierarchical structures, internal structures that corporate media institutions have, which is a general manager for a radio station, a program director who makes the decisions. I mean, I work in that very hierarchical institution that is Pacifica. Yep. And it's not working, let me tell you that.
That's why I got out.
And so, you know, it needs to change. There are a lot of problems, and I'll talk a little bit more about that this evening.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.